All right, let's dive into a case today. It's Burger v. New York.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's a fascinating case. It's from 1967, and it really kind of sets the stage for a lot of the electronic surveillance law that we deal with today.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of the foundational cases. When you think about how this all started, right?
Yeah.
Way back when.
We're talking old school bugs, hidden microphones.
Right. Exactly. None of this fancy digital stuff.
No, none of that. So, what is it about Burger that you think is so important for our understanding of electronic surveillance law?
Well, I mean, the core issue here is really about privacy
Right.
and how much the government can intrude on people's conversations,
Right.
even in places where they might think they have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
Right.
And that's something that's just as relevant today as it was back then.
Totally. So give us the rundown. What happened in this case? What were the facts?
Well, the case involved a guy named Ralph Berger, and he was convicted of conspiring to bribe the chairman of the New York State Liquor Authority.
Ooh, juicy.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a scandal there. And the evidence against him came from recordings, months and months of
Yeah.
recordings from these eavesdropping devices they planted in different places,
Okay.
including in attorneys' offices.
Attorney's offices. That's kind of a bold move, isn't it?
It is. And this was all possible because of a New York law at the time that was incredibly permissive when it came to surveillance.
Really?
Yeah, law enforcement could get a warrant and then basically just record everything
Right.
for weeks on end.
Everything. Like just a dragnet kind of approach.
Yeah, basically. They didn't even have to say exactly what crime they were investigating
Ugh.
or what conversations they wanted to hear.
That seems like a pretty clear violation of the Fourth Amendment, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, that was exactly what the Supreme Court thought when they took up the case.
Right.
They recognized that this kind of unchecked surveillance power really undermined the whole point of the Fourth Amendment.
Right. The Fourth Amendment is there to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures.
Exactly. And that means that the government can't just, go snooping around in our lives
Yeah.
or listening to our conversations without a really good reason.
Right. And they need to be specific too, right? Like they can't just say, "Oh, we think this person might be doing something illegal."
Yeah.
They gotta have some specific evidence and
Exactly.
a specific target.
They need probable cause and they need to be specific about, what they're looking for and
Right.
where they're looking for it.
Okay.
That's what this New York law was missing.
So the Supreme Court, obviously they weren't too happy with this law. What do they do? How do they
Yeah.
handle it?
Well, they struck it down. They said it was unconstitutional.
Okay, so they basically just said, "Nope, you can't do this anymore."
Yeah, but they didn't just, stop there. They went a step further and they created this framework for how electronic surveillance could be done constitutionally.
Ah, okay, so they laid down some ground rules.
Yeah. And that's what we now call the Burger
The
test.
Burger test.
It's got six parts.
Six parts. All right, so this is big, right? Like this Burger test, it's not just some obscure legal thing.
Oh no.
This has had a huge impact on the way surveillance is done today.
This is the foundation. When we think about how law enforcement can get access to our emails, our text messages, our location data,
Oh
all of
boy.
that,
Right.
the Burger test is where it all starts.
Wow. So break it down for us. What are the six parts? What are the key elements of this Burger test?
Well, the first one is probably the most obvious. It's probable cause. So the law enforcement has to convince a judge that there's a good reason to believe that a specific crime has been is being or is about to be committed.
Okay.
So no more just, fishing around,
Right.
hoping to find something. They got to have a real reason to be listening in.
Right.
And then the second part of the test is what we call particularity.
Particularity.
Yeah, which basically means that the warrant has to describe the conversations that they want to intercept.
Okay.
What are they actually hoping to hear? It can't just be this broad, authorization to record everything under the sun.
So they can't just tap the phone and say, "All right, we're going to listen for the next month
Nope.
and see what we find."
They have to be specific.
Okay. So probable cause, particularity, what else? What's number three?
All right, number three is a limited time frame.
Okay, so there's got to be like a a time limit on how long they can listen in.
Exactly. You know, surveillance can't go on indefinitely. The warrant has to say how long it's going to last. And it can't be an unreasonably long time.
All right, so we got probable cause, we got particularity, we got a time limit. What else?
All right, number four is immediate termination.
Okay, so what does that mean?
So once law enforcement gets the evidence that they were authorized to collect, the surveillance has to stop.
Right then and there.
Right then and there. Now, lingering around, just in case something else interesting comes up.
Okay.
They got to get in, get what they need, and get out.
Okay. All right, so... We're up to four. What are the last two? What's number five?
All right. So this is a really important one. This is notification.
Okay. So they have to tell the person that they were surveilling?
In most cases, yes.
Okay.
You know, obviously there are some exceptions.
Right.
You know, if there's a really good reason to keep it a secret.
Right. Right.
But generally speaking, the person who was subjected to the surveillance, they have to be notified afterwards.
Okay.
So, you know, there's at least some transparency there.
Right. Some accountability. All right. So we're up to five out of six. What's the what's that last element of the Berger test?
The last one is a return to the judge.
Okay.
So this means that law enforcement has to go back to the judge who issued the warrant.
Okay.
And explain what they collected during the surveillance.
So it's kind of like a check-in.
Right. It's a way of making sure that they didn't, you know, overstep their bounds.
Okay.
Or abuse their power.
So the Berger test really is all about striking that balance, right, between giving law enforcement the tools that they need.
Right.
But also protecting our privacy.
Yeah.
From you know, too much government intrusion.
Exactly.
It's fascinating to me how... A case from 1967, you know, dealing with technology that seems honestly kind of old-fashioned now, could have such a lasting impact.
It is amazing, isn't it?
You know, on the way that we approach surveillance in the digital age.
It really is, and it's a testament to, you know, how forward-thinking the Supreme Court was in recognizing that these issues were only going to become more important as technology advanced.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And it's clear that you know, the Supreme Court didn't always agree on how to approach these issues.
Oh yeah.
We've mentioned the Berger test, but there were also some pretty strong dissenting opinions in this case.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this was a really a divided court.
Yeah.
And those dissenting opinions, you know, they raise some really interesting questions about the limits of government power.
Right.
And the importance of individual privacy.
Well, let's dive into those dissenting opinions. I always love a good dissent.
Me too.
They can be really illuminating.
Yeah, it's like getting a peek inside the minds of the justices.
Right, exactly. So let's take a look at those dissenting opinions and see what other perspectives there were on this case.
All right, sounds good. So you want to talk about those dissents?
Yeah, let's get into it.
All right. Well, let's start with Justice Black. He was a real stickler for the text of the Constitution.
A textualist.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And he argued that the majority in Berger, they were reading too much into the Fourth Amendment.
Okay.
You know, he felt like the language about persons, houses, papers, and effects.
Right.
It just didn't extend to conversations.
Mm.
Like, if the Constitution doesn't explicitly say it,
right,
then it's not a protected right.
So he didn't really see conversations as falling under the umbrella of the Fourth Amendment.
Right. He felt like the court was kind of inventing new rights.
Hmm. Interesting. But even Black acknowledged that the Fourth Amendment protects against unreasonable searches and seizures.
Right.
So how did he reconcile that with his view on electronic surveillance?
Well, his view was that the warrant requirement itself was enough to ensure reasonableness.
Right.
So as long as law enforcement, you know, got a warrant,
right,
he felt like any surveillance was okay.
Hmm. So he basically trusted that judges would always, you know, use their best judgment and prevent any kind of overreach.
Yeah, that was his thinking.
Okay.
He was worried that the Berger decision would actually make it harder for law enforcement to do their jobs.
Okay.
Especially when it came to fighting, you know, organized crime.
Right. Yeah. And Justice White, he had a similar concern, right?
Absolutely. White was He was really worried about the practical implications of the ruling.
Okay.
He felt like electronic surveillance was a crucial tool.
Right.
You know, for law enforcement.
Especially when dealing with something like organized crime.
Right. You know, those complex criminal networks.
Right, right.
He argued that the court's new requirements would make it much more difficult to gather evidence.
Okay.
And to build cases against these sophisticated criminals.
So it's that classic tension, right, between privacy and security.
Yeah. You know, how do you balance the need to keep people safe with the need to protect individual rights?
Right, exactly. And that's a tension that, you know, we're still dealing with today.
Oh, absolutely.
It makes you wonder what black and white would think of, you know, all the surveillance technology we have now. Yeah. Right? Facial recognition, data mining, location tracking.
I mean, it's a whole different world.
It is.
Than the one they were dealing with back then.
Okay, so we've talked about black and white's dissents.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any other dissenting voices in this case?
Yeah, Justice Harlan also dissented.
Yeah.
But he had a slightly different take.
Okay, how so?
Well, he agreed that one of the eavesdrop orders in the case was problematic. The one targeting attorney Harry Nyer's office.
Okay.
Because it didn't have probable cause.
Right.
But he didn't think the whole New York law should be thrown out just because of that one bad apple.
So he had more of an issue with how the law was being applied.
Exactly.
Rather than the law itself.
Yeah. He felt like the court was overreaching a bit.
Okay.
By invalidating the entire statute.
Interesting. So he was maybe a little more sympathetic to law enforcement's perspective.
Yeah, I think you could say that.
Okay, so we've explored those dissents,
mm-hmm.
Which offer, you know, a really important counterpoint mm-hmm. to the majority's opinion.
Right.
But let's not forget about the concurrences.
Oh, yeah, those are good, too.
Yeah, the concurring opinions. Yeah. I mean, they can be just as fascinating.
Definitely.
It's like getting a glimpse into, you know, how different justices arrive at the same conclusion.
Right.
But through different paths of reasoning.
Yeah, different ways of thinking about the issues.
And the concurrences in Berger are no exception.
No, they're pretty interesting. We've got Justice Douglas, who actually took an even more expansive view of privacy than the majority.
Okay.
And then Justice Stewart, who kind of tried to find a middle ground.
All right, so let's start with Justice Douglas. What was his take on the case?
Well, Douglas was he was really passionate about privacy rights.
Okay.
And he felt like all electronic surveillance was unconstitutional.
All of it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Didn't matter if there was a warrant. Didn't matter if there was probable cause. He just thought it was a fundamental violation of the Fourth Amendment.
Okay. So for him, it wasn't just about having the right procedures in place.
Right.
It was about the very nature of electronic surveillance itself.
Exactly.
He saw it as inherently intrusive.
Yeah. And he was worried about the chilling effect it could have on free speech and association.
Mm.
You know, if people know that the government could be listening in,
right,
they might be less likely to speak their mind.
Right, to be open and honest.
Exactly.
Okay, so you've got Douglas taking this really strong stance against all forms of electronic surveillance.
Mm.
What about Justice Stewart? He tended to be a little more moderate in his views.
Yeah, Stewart was he was known for being very pragmatic.
Okay.
And his concurrence in Berger is a good example of that.
Okay.
He agreed with the majority that the New York law was unconstitutional.
Okay.
But he felt like the specific justifications for the eavesdropping in this particular case were just too vague.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for Stewart, it wasn't really about the law itself being bad.
Right.
It was more about how it was being used in this specific instance.
Yeah. He felt like the government hadn't really shown that they had a good enough reason to be listening in on Berger's conversations.
Interesting. So he was really focused on the facts of the case,
mm-hmm.
you know, making sure that the government's actions were justified.
Exactly.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground here. We've looked at the majority opinion, the Berger test, the dissenting opinions, the concurring opinions.
Yeah, we've really gone deep.
We have. It's clear that Berger v. New York was a really a landmark case.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it really sparked a debate about, you know, the balance between privacy and security
mm-hmm.
that we're still having today.
Yeah, it's a conversation that never really goes away.
No, it doesn't. So we've really dug deep into Berger v. New York. We've gone through the background, the Berger test, and all those opinions from the justices.
Lots of different perspectives on this one.
Definitely. But now I kind of want to shift gears a little.
Okay.
And think about, you know, the big picture.
The legacy of Berger.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. How has this case from 1967, you know, shaped the way we approach privacy and surveillance today?
Well, I mean, the most obvious impact is Title III.
Right, the federal wiretapping law?
Exactly. Berger basically forced Congress's hand to pass that law.
So you're saying, like, Congress had to come up with something that would actually pass constitutional muster.
Right. They couldn't just, you know, ignore the Supreme Court's decision.
Right. And Title III, that's still the law that governs wiretapping and electronic surveillance in the U.S. today.
It is. And it's basically a codification of the Berger test.
So all those requirements we talked about, probable cause, particularity,
yeah.
You know, the time limits, the notification,
mm-hmm.
all of that came directly from Berger.
It did. But I think Berger's impact goes beyond just those specific rules.
Okay.
It really started a national conversation about privacy.
Right. That tension between privacy and security.
Exactly. And that conversation is more important than ever today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about all the data that we generate now.
Right.
With our phones, our computers, you know, everything we do online.
It's mind-boggling.
It is.
Yeah.
And the potential for abuse is huge.
Absolutely.
So the question is, you know, is the Berger test enough
mm-hmm.
to protect our privacy in this new world of data mining and facial recognition and all of that?
Yeah, that's the big question. And honestly, there's no easy answer.
Right.
I mean, some people think that Berger, it was groundbreaking for its time.
Right.
But it doesn't go far enough anymore.
Okay. So what are they proposing? Like what needs to change?
Well, some folks think we need to revisit the whole idea of a reasonable expectation of privacy.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, back in 1967 when Berger was decided, it was a lot easier to define what was private.
Okay.
You know, you had your home, your phone calls, your letters.
Right.
But now so much of our lives is online,
right.
You know, and it's not always clear what we should be able to keep private.
Yeah, it's a blurry line.
It is. And it's a line that's constantly shifting
right.
as technology advances.
So it sounds like Berger was really just the beginning of this conversation.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
And it's a conversation that we need to keep having.
Oh, absolutely. Especially now.
Well, we are just about out of time for this deep dive.
Ready?
I know. It flew by. But before we wrap up, is there anything else about Berger, about this whole issue of privacy and surveillance that you think our listeners should keep in mind?
Well, I think the most important thing is to remember that privacy is not just something that the government gives us.
Right.
It's something that we have to fight for.
So it's not just about knowing our rights.
Right.
It's about actively defending them.
Exactly. And that means, you know, speaking out when you see something that's wrong,
right.
Supporting organizations that are fighting for privacy rights,
mm-hmm.
being careful about how you use technology.
Right. You know, all of that.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
It's easy to feel powerless in the face of all this, you know, this technology and this massive data collection.
Yeah.
But we're not. We do have a voice.
You do.
And we need to use it.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into Berger v. New York.
It's been a pleasure.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Keep those minds sharp and those privacy settings strong. We'll see you next time.